This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
I started by turning the microphone on, and I'm looking in the room, and I'm seeing that people seem to be able to hear me. So that's a good first sign. And I hope, it's quite loud suddenly. I don't know if anybody else noticed that. That anyone who is on Zoom is also able to hear me. We're going to try to keep track of that and pay attention to all of us as gathered together in two ways, which is, I think, a pretty good way to go into Christian formation, is that we don't have just one way of being. We have multiple ways, and we can be open to new ones. I want to say happy Juneteenth, and I want to say happy Father's Day. This is a coincidence that will happen from time to time now in the future. And that's great. I grew up with my mother's birthday and Father's Day occasionally happening on the same day and definitely happening on the same weekends. And so that was a busy time already in my house. I want to say a couple more words about myself. I have been a member of St. David's since 1999. I started out here. Okay, great. Okay. Welcome. Okay. I thought I broke the Zoom. Pretty loud. So I joined here as a young parent of two very young daughters, one of whom hated going to church and the other who loved it. And so I obviously became a member of Bethel. And I was on the Bethel worship team for a long, from the moment we opened our beautiful, I started before when we were down in the basement and when we were in Sumner's while we were building Bethel. And then when Bethel was opened, I was one of the people who was a greeter for about 5 or 6 years, building that and being a part of that community. And so I'm trying to see if I have any of the Bethel people here from that time, not seeing anyone, but maybe on Zoom. I also want you all to know that in addition to studying theology over the last 5 years, in my past life, there's two things you should know I have done that will help you understand what we're going to do today. One is that I worked in Texas politics. I worked for 10 years in the Texas legislature doing environmental and women's health advocacy and legislation. I ran the Alliance for a Clean Texas, which did legislative and regulatory coalition oversight of statewide environmental and energy issues. And that's how I got into Texas politics, other than being a person who had children in public school. And the other thing is that I came to Texas first. I'm not a native Texan, probably obvious from my voice, but not always. In 1993, it'll be 30 years next summer, to take a job at Rice University as an academic librarian. And I'm a former librarian. I'm not currently a librarian, but once you're a librarian, you're always a librarian. So this really is a book talk, and I was trained professionally how to do that. And when you do a book talk, you always hold up the book and you never give away the ending. And I have followed one of those rules, and I'm probably going to break the other one. And in fact, we're not even going to talk so much about what is in this book as in the how of this book, how this book talks about Juneteenth, how Annette Gordon Reed talks about Juneteenth, what she talks about history, Texas history, but how we can all start having a different relationship and do history differently. So that's what we're talking about here today. So the question I want to start with is how should we observe Juneteenth? For many of us, Juneteenth is a relatively new holiday. Now, in the African-American community, especially in Texas, that is not the truth. But as a white non-Texan, it wasn't a day I grew up knowing about. And so that's something I want you all to know about me, is that I come to this as a learner, not as a person with a lot of lived experience. So one of my questions is how should we observe Juneteenth? But I'm going to rephrase it. It's what should we do on Juneteenth? What should we do on this day? And, that's what she answers, I think, in this book. and really beautifully. I also had the opportunity to listen to a Zoom presented by the ADL, Anti-Defamation League of Texas, this week, which was an interview with, where she did a presentation and then answered questions on that Zoom. And so I had the good fortune to hear Annette Gordon Reed, who's a professor at Harvard and is the author of The Hemingses of Monticello, and is the scholar who has done the establishing work on Thomas Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings and her family and their family lineage. That has transformed, I would say, our approaches to early American history by making and going into the personal, the race, and the both ideological and the political that came out of that. I mean, it's a big thing and a small thing. And I think that's part of what we're talking about today too. So she answers this about what should we do on Juneteenth? And she's really focused on Texas history in this book. And that's why I think it's perfect for all of us here at St. David's. It's about Juneteenth as a Texas event and Texas history in response. How should we start thinking about Texas history now that we are thinking about things such as Juneteenth widely rather than in specifically African American community or in other communities where there's a lot of participation together on Juneteenth, where someone like me starts wanting to know more about Juneteenth. And so her approach, I would say, is characterized by three things. It's by being open to things. Oh, thanks, Chris, you can change the slide. Open to the things that we did not know or learn, to omissions, to the stuff. I mean, I don't know what I don't know. So it's hard to learn that. But once there are sources, people, experiences where I can learn things I do not know, one thing happens and I think to myself, why didn't I ever know this? How is it I did not know about this, that, or the other? How did I not know about Juneteenth until in my actual memory of it, I'll let you know, until I was a grown person in Texas. And it wasn't right away when I got here. My memory takes place about 10 years after I got here. She's suggesting that we ask critical, we be critical, meaning not criticizing, but open-minded and thoughtful, analytical, looking behind the what's into the whys. And one of the whys that I think that's so important for us to think about is, why did I learn it this way and not that way? And that allows us to have to ask some important questions about how we were taught history, which is what she does in this book. She talks about learning Texas history in fourth and seventh grade in Conroe, in Montgomery County, right, in the 1960s and 1970s. She was the first African-American student at her middle school. She'd gone to an all-black, it was before the full integration fully was taking place in Montgomery County, but her parents put her in this school early to sort of get things going, not as a movement, but to help her in her education is the way she understood. Her mother was a teacher at the all-black school. So some of these questions about what is the difference also between the knowledge of history that I as a white person have and that people of color have. And I just want to say that clearly what I'm going to be talking about and my learning is particular to not just me, but is characteristic of many white people who do not learn about, I did not know about East St. Louis until I became friends, a major race, what's called a race riot, but a major moment of violence against African-American people until I became friends with a woman, African-American woman from St. Louis, whose father had been the editor of one of the leading black paper in St. Louis. Now that was until 2013, I didn't really learn about that till then. Now, why didn't I learn about this and I learned about other things is a question I ask myself now. And it's not a question I always ask myself, but it's a question I think is important. It's a question at the heart of this book on Juneteenth. And last is that it's personal. And by personal, I mean that my personal story, my personal history, your personal experiences, history, family history is relevant and important. And it's an important entry point into understanding history. It's an important entry point into understanding the omissions of history, the things I don't know. But it's also important because making history personal, that's what I call it, making history personal is what I'm trying to do myself rather than take history personally. Now, when I take history personally, I'm going to be feeling criticized, reactive, I'm embarrassed. There's certain things I'm ashamed about. I'm ashamed about things on a very high level, but there are very specific small things I also have had a lot of, I have not wanted, I've avoided and denied not looking into certain things. They make me more than uncomfortable. And I, the way I experienced my upbringing, we don't talk about that. So I'm just going to say that part of this is how we're going to go to the theological aside. And apologies, I've already talked a lot more than I like to. And I went to school to become a theologian, and you know how theologians are probably. They like to write, they like to talk, they like to think and write some more. And this is what I think I'm bringing to all of us today that I'd like to share, which is that ethics, the history is a matter of ethics. And ethics is about responsibility, how we behave responsibly, and what is our responsibility. Because I'm in church, I'm very happy that I can add the adjective that is in my mind always when I think of the words ethics and responsibility, which is Christian ethics, Christian responsibility. And that's something I think we all share here. Ethics asks the question of what is my responsibility as a Christian in whatever particular situation? Another way of phrasing that is, how do I need to respond to this situation in the here and now? Responsibility depends upon my ability to respond. So what we're doing today is exploring our ability to respond to history. Part of that is what we are, both here and now, and as members of family and other larger groups. We're responsible for things and responsible to people and responsible to history, I believe. For lots of white people I know, including myself, this aspect of my responsibility can make me feel uncomfortable. To give an example, among many, in my own life, my great-great-great, and I probably missing a great there, grandfathers were slave owners in North Carolina. One was an officer in the Confederate Army. One reason this makes me very uncomfortable is that I was raised in the North. And so I never learned or received the imagination, the lessons that was something to have pride in. It was always portrayed as something that was wrong. And that then wide brushstrokes about the wrongness of this place and this society where that happened, which were in conflict with the fact that my grandparents, whom I knew to be the most Christian people in my life, lived in Western North Carolina, and that my brilliant, beautiful mother was a very proud Southerner. So I was conflicted and confused early on. And I didn't ask questions like what was going on during desegregation in the 1950s when my grandfather was a principal and a school board president, director, whatever. Learn not to ask those questions. So I was afraid and ashamed of what I might learn. So what I'm telling you, what I'm saying is that the responsibility on my part is to put some of that, is to learn to be okay with that, be okay with being uncomfortable about my own aspects of my own family history, get okay. And that took a long time. That wasn't a quick thing. And then to start learning so that I could become an actual learner, not just about the particulars in my own family history, but a different kind of learner about our history together, and Texas history in particular. So this is about openness. That's this openness to being, to doing history. And it's also that personal, this business of being personal. I'm just going to say a couple more words about Christian responsibility, and then we'll move into Juneteenth specifically. The other aspect of Christian responsibility that I really want for us to have in our minds and hearts and bodies this morning is our ability to respond to someone or something other than myself, to set aside my personal issues, thoughts, feelings, responses, reactions, and see and respond to your experiences, feelings, to your history. That is, I think, one of the keys of this book, is it's a way for me to learn how to respond to a history that wasn't mine, and to Texas history, not just the history of Juneteenth as an event, but in general, to Texas history. So I've already, I think that it's very different if we decide that we don't know enough to have all the answers, that we can listen, and that your my job or your job is not to step in and fix what was wrong right off the bat. I'm not stepping in to take care of and address the wrongs immediately. I'm starting by learning about the history I don't know. And we can talk about that in another time. Although I'm losing track of time, I see where we are. I've already said a lot of things, and some of them are not necessarily easy to hear. So I'm going to have us do something. It's not talking. And for those of you on Zoom, you can do this yourself. It's a settling practice. To do this kind of work, to learn to history differently, be open to things that I don't know, is unsettling for me. It has been very unsettling. And one of the best things I've had the opportunity to do is to read in classes. I was assigned this book in classes at Seminary of the Southwest and at Union. It's called My Grandmother's Hands, and it's by a social worker named Resma Menakem, and I'll give the name of it to Mona in case she wants, anybody has a question about it. And he feels very strongly that we need to address that the history of race in the United States is a source of trauma for many people, and that is something we experience in our body. So what to do this work, we're going to take a couple of minutes and just be quiet and do a body practice, a settling practice. And I'm just going to read what he's got. It's the first one in the book. We're not getting into anything complicated. It's just to let us have our be here now and regroup after I've said all that stuff, and we'll talk about, and you will get a chance to talk to each other for a couple minutes in a minute. So my talking time is about to take a break. So what we're going to do is sit with your feet, both feet on the ground, if you would. And this tells us to take a private spot, but we're doing this to be together. So this is just first to do one big inhale and one exhale. All right, sit comfortably, take a few breaths. Turn your head and slowly look around in all directions. I know it's a little awkward when there's someone right next to you or behind you. Orient yourself in the surrounding space. Notice the height of the ceiling, the height and color of each wall, any doors or windows. Take note of any plants or animal life nearby. Note what sounds you hear, any smells that fill the air, any warmth or coolness, and any colors that stand out. When you're done scanning your environment, face forward once again and return your attention to your body. Sense how your feet rest on the ground and how your butt rests on the seat. Now notice any other sensations in your body, in the bend in your knees, your spine, straight or curved, your belly and any tension you hold there, and your chest expanding and shrinking with each breath. Notice what your body experiences inside your clothing. Pay attention to where your body touches your underwear, your socks or stockings, your shirt or blouse, your pants or skirt or dress. Starting at the top of your head, bring your attention slowly down through your body. Notice each sensation as your attention passes through it. Warmth, coolness, relaxation, tightness, softness, pressure, energy, and numbness. One deep inhalation. And one more deep exhalation. All right, we did it. Y'all did it. So I'm going to move on to a couple of definitions to get us started in our diving deeper into Juneteenth. And can you tell me what time it is, Chris? Great. When Mona said it was a lecture, I was like, oh no, it's not a lecture. Guess what? It seems like it's a lecture right now. I don't know if you were expecting a lecture, but I guess you were, so thank you. So these are the definitions. We're going to start with the harder one, which is, what is white supremacy? And I'm using the definition that is in my grandmother's hands, given to me in my womanist ethics class at Seminary of Southwest. What is white supremacy? And this is his words, and then there's another definition. When people hear the words white supremacy or white body supremacy, they often think of neo-Nazis and other extremists with hateful and violent agendas. That is certainly one extreme type of white body supremacy. But mainstream American culture is infused with a more subtle and less overt variety. In her book, What Does It Mean to Be White? Robin DiAngelo describes white supremacy as the all-encompassing centrality and assumed superiority of people defined and perceived as white, and the practices based upon this assumption. White supremacy does not refer to individual white people per se and their individual intentions, but to a political, economic, social system of domination. The system is based on the historical and current accumulation of structural power that privileges, centralizes, and elevates white people as a group. I do not use it to refer to extreme hate groups. I use the term to capture the pervasiveness, magnitude, and normalcy of white dominance and assumed superiority. I was going to ask, how many of you all are familiar with that kind of definition? I was going to ask for a show of hands. How many of y'all are pretty familiar with that kind of definition? Okay, now if you're not and you feel comfortable, and if you don't, it's okay, because if you don't know this, I've already said, it's okay to not know what you don't know. So
I'm just a little bit confused. I've never heard white bodies.
Okay, I will say something about that. Okay, I'm going to repeat that for the folks on the Zoom, because this question didn't come up to the mic. That's okay. It's, what about white body supremacy? That is Rezma Menakem's chosen, I get so confused when that happens, expression for white supremacy. He is talking about bodies. And so he talks about white body supremacy. And he is addressing racialized trauma in the body, what's called somatically. And so I'll answer one more question, but we can,
don't worry about that.
We can talk about it afterwards if you would like. I'd be happy to. I'm familiar with it. My sister-in-law, I have not been trained in this method, but my sister-in-law has actually been in training in Minnesota on this method. Hello.
Okay.
We've got somebody on Zoom. If you could mute.
Hold on. Hello, friends on Zoom. I can't see your faces, unfortunately. Thank you. Thank you. So I'll be happy to talk more about that afterwards. And if when we have a couple of minutes for questions, if that's important, then we can go back to that. Okay. So that's his words. And I just think it was a good, good introduction to a really good definition. So the other thing we need to define, let's go forward, Chris, is what is Juneteenth? Oh no, it's all over now, people. All the technology, all the kings, all the queen's men. My husband is unbelievably kind to do this. So this is Annette Gordon Reed in the first page, second sentence on, and I'm gonna read it out loud. What is Juneteenth? That's my question. June 19th, 1865, shortened to Juneteenth, was the day that enslaved African Americans in Texas were told that slavery had ended 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed and just over 2 months after Confederate General Robert E. Lee had surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox. Despite the formal surrender, the Confederate Army had continued to fight on in Texas until mid-May. It was only after they finally surrendered that Major General Gordon Granger, while at his headquarters in Galveston, prepared General Order Number 3, announcing the end of legalized slavery in the state.
It's 65.
So it's all happening in 1965. However, this next explains that was Granger's order did not end. This is another quotation a little later in that preface. Slavery in the country. That did not happen officially until December 1865, when the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified by the necessary number of states. But it is significant that Texas was the site of the tail end of Confederate war effort. As the war had been fought to preserve slavery, celebrating Juneteenth throughout the land is a fitting way to mark the end of that effort. I'm gonna ask a question now, another show of hands question. How many people here learned somewhere in school that Texas was, or maybe from your family, just know that Texas was the site of the final battle of the Civil War? I'm gonna let the Zoom folks know it's about seven people, I think. Because the owl, you can't really see the detail of the group in my experience. So that's okay, but I feel a little better because I didn't know that until.
I was taught Texas history in college and I hear nothing about Juneteenth.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask if we can, I know I've been doing a lot of talking, but because we have this microphone problem, I'm worried about the Zoom folks. So Chris, can you go forward and I think it's important on Juneteenth, and this is my last, and then we're gonna have a question that we're gonna get to talk about with each other. That on Juneteenth, one thing we can do is read General Order Number 3. And I think it's important to do that the way it's important to think about the Declaration of Independence on 4th of July. And I grew up with the newspaper printing a reproduction of the Declaration of Independence in the paper on 4th of July. So General Order Number 3 is quite short and simple. The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere. Okay, so that's General Order Number 3. And I think in another time, I could sit with a group of people and just talk about General Order Number 3, what it says and what it doesn't say. And fortunately, this book gives us, this is the book talk part, gives us a really good set of questions and a good way to understand this. And she compares it to, I can't even go into this, but this book is a good way to do that. Let me say that. So here's the question. I'm finally going to get, now it's your turn to think and to stop listening to me for a minute. What is your first memory of Juneteenth? It's a reflective question. What is your first memory of Juneteenth? We've talked about it. For some of us, it's how did you celebrate it? For others, what happened in your community on Juneteenth? For others like me, it's how did I first learn about it? So I want you to really think about that. Now, if you're sitting near someone and you feel all right, would you just turn to your neighbor, as we say, instead of passing the peace, and just say, I learned about it either in the year or the place where you remember it, where this memory takes place. Like, I was at school, I was living in Houston, I was whatever. So we can have a little moment of, and Zoom people, we're having some din here. It's going to be blah, 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 blah. And Zoom, please put it in the chat. Please put your memories in the chat. It'd be great to know them. Okay, let's draw our conversation to a close. And thank you for the folks on Zoom who shared your memories in the chat. I'm not able to read those, but I will read them later. And boy, there were a lot of things to talk about. That's awesome. That's fantastic. I'm really happy that worked, because you never know. It could have been and I'm pretty sure how my grandfather would have responded, a man of very few words. But he was taught not to talk about things. So it's really great to be in a room of people who are willing to talk about things. So
instead of having you come up to the mic and tell each of us that, at the end, we're going to come back to this question and to a couple, another thing. And there's a way that we're going to share this, I hope. I just want to take a minute to say some things that Dr. Gordon Reed mentioned in the Zoom I heard this week, because I think it's my responsibility to her, having listened to her, to share this with you. She was asked, how should we observe, that was the first question, how should we observe Juneteenth? And her answer was super clear. We should celebrate and we should commemorate. And she explained celebration, and celebration in her family has been going on for generations, and described her celebrations. And then she said, but for people who don't have a tradition of celebration, for people who are allies, there is good reason to celebrate Juneteenth as a great moment in the history of human rights. So it is appropriate, it is fitting, as we say theologically, for us to celebrate, to express joy, gratitude, to throw praise in today, and to feel that, and to feel joy. It's also important to recognize, and she brought this up in this in her talk, the importance of Juneteenth as a moment and expression of Black joy. And that Black joy is an essential foundation to the African-American experience, to the African-American history, and to the resilience required among people who have been oppressed historically and continue to face systematic oppression, violence, and inequity. So Black joy is a central part of Juneteenth. And since I am not an African-American person, I can observe and uplift Black joy without trying to take it on myself. But I can have my joy in this day, and I have joy. And I have joy just being here with all of you today. This is really special to me. I've been imagining a day like this at St. David's since the day I walked in the doors in 1999. I say this sometimes, but this is a dream come true. I always wanted us to be this kind of community. And I don't think all of us were ready to have these kind of conversations. So that being a room full of chatty Cathys is the best. The other thing, though, that we're to do is commemorate. And that's where we get to those three things. How do we commemorate? How do we have memory with? Commemorate. So how do we have memory with, and I've already said, is to be open, to be critical, and to be personal in our approach to history, to the history around Juneteenth, to the history around Texas, to the history of our country, to the things going on right now in the world. It's a widely applicable style, approach, but it's particularly useful for us in Texas right now, I believe, because we are facing battles about history in our state. Well, how it gets taught, what can be said, what cannot be said. It is a battleground, and the last legislative session passed some very restrictive changes in how Texas history can be taught in public schools. And if you're not familiar with it, it's called the 1836 Project. Am I right, Mitty? Is that, do you remember? That's, and again, that's not the topic of this, but that is our context right now. It's why this is actually not just about, I'm learning about the past. I am participating in the present by being an active, critical, open, and personally, both responsibility as a Christian, but personally as my way of being ethical, responsible to you, able to respond. So there are several things I want to say about this book, but I'm gonna pick one topic, because it relates to my first memory of Juneteenth,
that I, and then my husband told me, oh, but you knew about it before that. I'm like, yeah, but that wasn't the one that came to my mind. Which is, this book isn't all about Juneteenth. It's about going to Six Flags. It's about the Alamo. It's about, I'm trying to think of all the funny things. I mean, not just funny, but it's about the actual first African to be on the continental North American long prior to 1619. So there's a wide range of topics she covers. But she starts with the way that Texans learn about Texas history and the things that she learned. And the big one is that she learned three big symbols of Texas were the cowboy, the rancher, and the oilman. Remember, this was 1960s and 70s, but that was it. She makes the argument that what is missing is the plantation owner. That there's just sort of an absence there about the history of Texas as a place where cotton would be raised and people would become rich who were engaged in chattel slavery. And that the people who came from all over the southern part of the United States to Texas to colonize during the Spanish occupation and then Mexican, I don't know, occupation's the wrong word. Sorry, I got caught on that. That we don't see that part of the history. She didn't get taught that part of the history in school. And it gave me, she said, and the thing is that Texans almost all get this problem. And you can move to Texas like me and not be a real Texan and have this problem, which is, what is it like to live in the desert? Yeah. What is it like and have friends come here? And my father-in-law was just the worst of this. It's like, oh my gosh, I thought there were going to be cactuses. I can't believe it's so green. You know, the good news is a lot of people wear boots and hats. So at least we got that going. But, and we moved to Houston in 1993, and it sure does not look like West Texas. And it does not look like Arizona or the mountains of California where all the Westerns were filmed. So this idea of the ranch, the cowboy, the rancher, the oil man goes hand in hand with Texas is a Western place. And in the American imagination, Texas is a Western place. And so I'm going to get to this memory of mine. My first memory, real memory about Juneteenth, I believe comes when my oldest daughter took Texas history in fourth grade. And that would have been 2005. And I learned Texas history. That was the first time I learned Texas history. And then the next year, because our daughters are back to back in school, I got to take Texas history again with my daughter, Maisie. So I learned a lot of things. And I was like, what is this year of Texas history? There was not a year of New York history. I don't think there's a year of North Carolina history, although it seems like there was. And, but here was this year. And then it came back in seventh grade. And it had another year of it. And it was much more advanced. And there was an assignment that was Texas. Is Texas a Western state or a Southern state? And this assignment made me so angry that I told my daughters that they should intentionally fail it. That they should intentionally write that it is both. That you cannot make this an either or question. And I was very, very firm in my belief that this could not be an either or question. What I did not think about until I read on Juneteenth, literally, until this spring, I did not think about that question as a forward thinking approach to history in Texas schools. Because the possibility of being a Southern state was presented. That wasn't in the history that Annette Gordon Reed. And I bet for people, okay, I haven't done the most obvious raise of hands. How many people took Texas history in fourth and seventh grade in this room? Oh, we're good. We got a good almost half the room, Zoom folks.
And Zoom, please, if you took it in fourth and seventh grade, please let us know. So that was a change. That was a major change to even include that possibility. And that's something, you know, I get white hot mad really fast. And I wonder about that sometimes. I get fighting mad. And as I've studied things about both whiteness as a concept, but also about the history of the South, I think there's a lot of us who get fighting mad really fast. We learn to be fighting mad fast as a reaction to anything that punctures through, I think. That's just my opinion, not Annette Gordon-Reed's. But this gets to memoir, thinking about ourselves, thinking about what I'm bringing to this mix, how mad I was about this question. And what are the questions I didn't ask about Texas history? Like, oh, how did this question end up here? Or what do I know about plantations in Texas? Not very much. Or what do I know about other aspects of Texas history? Not very much. And I've learned a little bit since my two-year tours of duty in fourth and seventh grade Texas history. And I say that because my daughters did not really like the class. And I don't blame, I think, I maybe blame myself on that. But they also got dragged to the Capitol a lot, so that got kind of boring. So I think their resistance might have been somewhat more resisting their mom. But I want to say, I'm looking at my notes here because I think I want to share one more thing, and then we're going to do our talk. That I learned, when I think about the history I learned and why I don't know much about Texas history, why I ask myself that, when I think, why don't I know about Texas history? Well, it has to do with how history was taught to me, because I wasn't in Texas. I learned it mainly when I moved here. But what did I learn? I tried to keep thinking, what did I learn? Well, I knew that it became a state. I didn't really understand the Mexican-American War. It was just something that happened before the Civil War. The thing I reflect back on when I first learned American history in fifth grade, it was in the incredible lead up to the bicentennial. And I don't know, I'm 57, and it was 1974-75. And it was as if the entire history of the United States stopped at about 1800. Because we spent so much time on that revolutionary period because of the bicentennial was coming, which was literally the biggest, funnest, coolest thing that was ever gonna happen. And then we learned the Civil War. It was like, oh, the revolution is so great. All this good stuff, it's happening now, where all these colonies became states. And yes, we probably learned a little bit about slavery, but we didn't really. And then there was the Civil War. And for me, studying about the Civil War was very difficult because I was taught the Civil War in a way, I think I've already said this, that made the South into a truly evil place and the site of terrible people who were also stupid. And the stupidity was what I really probably took the biggest offense at, because my mother was brilliant and I knew that already. And so I sat in a school listening about the Civil War and learning about it, and it basically telling me I was a bad person somehow. That's how I took it. That's the thing I internalize. That's what I've been talking about. What are some of those things that I bring to history? That's when I take it personally. But what if I make it personal instead? And I think, why was I taught history the way I was at that time and in that place? And what wasn't taught there?
And one thing I learned about recently, and Chris and I, my husband and I were talking about last night, one thing I'd never was taught was the role of the sugar industry in the city of New York and the extreme wealth that it created. And the wealth that it created is at the foundation of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. That family that had Domino Sugar, that created the largest and most modern sugar processing plant on earth in 1864, in the middle of the Civil War, a very large, not just very large, the largest, most modern sugar refinery was built in Brooklyn. They were getting sugar from the slave states. They weren't getting sugar from New York State. They do not grow sugarcane in New York State. I do know that. I learned enough New York history to know what our crops were. It was not sugarcane. And yet, this extraordinary fortune is at the heart of the history of the city of New York. But we never learned any, I mean, yes, we were fifth grade, but maybe in 11th grade when we did, or 10th grade when we did history, US history again. We never learned anything about the economics of New York City, where we lived, and the Civil War, and chattel slavery, and the transatlantic triangular trade. We just knew that we knew better. And the concept carpetbagger was poo-pooed. And the complexity of Reconstruction was completely gone. And post-Reconstruction, we just didn't learn that. And I think about why that changes my attitude about everything. Learning that there's complexity everywhere, and not just one place is complicated and the other one isn't. So that's a personal story about history with me. And I'm going to ask now, and I'm going to do an exercise because I'm a librarian. So what I keep thinking about is, okay, what is something like that that's going on right now with Texas for me? And here it is, Juneteenth, and I'm here to tell you, I've spent a lot of time over the last, a long time, but particularly the last 10 years studying civil rights movement. And I have visited a lot of places, including I've been to Alabama multiple times. I've been to Georgia, North Carolina, St. Louis, Louisiana, New Orleans, and I have not been to Galveston.
Oh, dear.
I've visited in the past, but I have not gone because of its role in history. And I will go almost anywhere because of what it did, its role in history. And one of my pleasures is traveling and learning about history.
So have you ever been to San Francisco?
Can I finish what I'm going to say? And then I'm going to give us a chance to write something down. I'm just going to ask for just a second. And I see people have to go to church. Here's the question. What is a thing that you are curious about Texas history that you have not learned? Is there something? I know I need to go to Galveston and learn about Juneteenth in Galveston because I like to do things in person, in the place. Now I'm going to ask, I know you wanted to say something. Can you come up to the mic and say, ask the question? I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry about this, but if anybody would like to now come up and say, there's a thing I'd like to know about Texas that I don't, you gotta come up to the mic. I hate that, but we're gonna do that because of Zoom. I'm always embarrassed. And Mona, is there anything in the chat that somebody would like to share after we get the first, I'd like to learn this?
This is not so much about what I want to know as what the people in the generations after me want to know. I'm a bridge between my mother's family. She is one generation removed from slave owners in the Civil War, including one who was here at the laying of the cornerstone of St. David's. I'm the historian for my family, for my generation. I have cousins in my teens, in their teens and 20s and 30s. When they learn what our family has been, they're revolted. To us, it may seem new, but to them, it's a source of deep revulsion. And my job as a family historian is to help them both learn the things that they never learned, but also to move past that revulsion and onto what can be done to atone for what we did.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to ask that we be quiet with that for just a minute. That's the deep, good question. Okay. Mona, were you going to read it? No, Mona, what? Please. Yes. Please.
What is the impact of the take on
it? Microphone is here.
Yeah. What is the impact of the Tejanos on Texas history? Well, that's a big question. It's a great question to ask. What is the impact of the Tejanos, of Tejano people, on Texas? I will say, is there anyone else who has a question that they'd like to share? Ellen, if you go to the microphone, and we can have both questions. We have enough time for both questions, and then I'm going to just say, bring us to close.
It's just odd to me that you were talking about Galveston, because a close friend of mine who visits there regularly sent me something from their historical association talking about my family, who's all from Galveston. And it was back in the 1850s and early 60s. And it refers to the servants that they had in their various states and estates in the city and big fancy houses. And I just was wondering, should I assume that those were slaves?
That's your question.
That's my question.
That's your question.
Check the census.
Yeah, and okay, please come on up to the microphone.
I'm new to Texas, like you. I have lived in Chicago and in Michigan. So I am curious, having lived through the civil rights movement as in my late teens and early college years in Chicago, I am curious, how did the civil rights movement play out in Texas? It would have been different, I am sure, than it was in Chicago.
It's a great question. So those are examples of really, really good questions. And one of them is an example of the kind of question I think that we all need to be aware of in our spiritual preparation for doing this kind of thinking and being engaged in history. Russ, thank you. That is my question as well. And right now, doing this talk is part of that work for me. But I'm putting myself on the line. I'm holding myself accountable, and I'm doing it in front of you. So you all can ask me next Juneteenth. Lizzie, did you get to Galveston this year? I hope you did. And if you see me in between, like, have you gotten there? Do you have a plan? Check in on me. Help me stay true to my intention. Because I get busy. I have other things I want to do. And also there's still that part of me that's like, I don't really want to deal with the stuff I don't want to deal with. And if I do these things, then I am able to be of service and be the bridge in my generation, in my family, to help with the pain of certain memories and of certain legacies for those experiencing pain, and to help with the repair for those engaged in repair. And we're not all going to be doing repair, and we're not all going to be doing the level of pain reflection, painful reflection, difficult reflection. I did that work with my mom, and it was really, really hard for her. but I really admire how she stuck to it. And I feel that I have to go forward with that. And I hope that you feel that you do too. And I hope that you will read this book and you will find tools in it, anecdotes, and ideas that will help you do that. And that's all I have to say. I know I haven't left time for normal questions, but I appreciate you letting me talk so much and listening so well. And I hope I get the opportunity to listen to you tell me or others in our congregation about your making history personal. And that's it. Thank y'all. Thanks, Zoomers. Thank you so much for those of you on Zoom.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.